Good morning, everyone. This is Brian Beckman. I'm an architect at Microsoft Corporation, and I have with me today Dr. Peter Chin, who is one of the most influential computer scientists in history, originator of the entity relationship model. I have Dr. Jose Blakely, another architect in the SQL Server product unit, and I have Mr. Britt Johnston with me this morning. He is an executive in the data programmability section of SQL Server. Jose and Britt are responsible for bringing Microsoft's new entity framework to the market. And in some sense, the entity framework is a realization of Dr. Chin's entity relationship model. Let me begin with Peter by asking, you don't mind if I call you Peter, do you?
No, go ahead.
Thank you very much. How did you get involved in computing in the first place, computing in general and in particular, data management and data processing?
In my college years, I stepped into the wrong classroom, so listened to a computer lecture, so I become more interested in computers. Then I become a graduate student at Harvard, and I was majoring in computer science and applied mathematics. But I find out there are a lot of problems. Myself and many people have a lot of data, and if we look at the offices, look at the home, a lot of files, it's very unorganized. So I think it's very important to solve the problem of data management. So fortunately, I have the opportunity after getting my PhD from Harvard. I joined Honeywell and working on the data management and distributed systems. And in that place, I started to think about the idea of entity relationship model. And then after that, I joined MIT and published the first paper on the EL model.
The entity relationship model couldn't have just come out of thin air, though. It must have had some sort of origin in your mind somewhere, because at the time, people were struggling with all kinds of ways of modeling data as hierarchies, as graphs, and trees, and whatnot. So the entity relationship seems to be a departure from some of those earlier ideas. How did you come up with it?
Very interesting. I think initially, I was working in this area and tried to figure out the best way to organize data. And many people started from a low level, getting more and more high-level abstraction. At that time, there were debate between, as you just mentioned, hierarchical structure, relational structure, relational model just started. So, and the relational model is one way to move up the abstraction level to a higher level. And it turned out from my background, and I find out doing something even higher level would be better, something like the abstraction to the level of entities and relationship. And I didn't realize the real reason until about 10 or 15 years later. And when people keep on asking me around the world, why you came up with this particular model? And turned out to be somewhat related to my Chinese heritage.
Now that's very interesting. How did it relate to the Chinese heritage?
It turned out the Chinese character has the concept of modeling. Basically, each character, some of the characters are representation of the real entities in the world. So there's a special symbol for some entity in the sky, for example, like the sun, like a moon, and each one have a different symbol, different characters.
So the character is almost a picture of the entity.
That's correct. Not only about that, but it's also have the concept of composition, the relationship between different entities. So if you look at different entities and put together, you can find out the relationship between them. So for example, if you put the mouth on your face, the mouth of the bird, and put together with the character called bird. So the bird and mouth together, what kind of meaning can you infer? Turn out the bird and with a mouth together is basically singing, like singing a song or whatever.
Yes, very interesting. So the concept of compositionality, which is a higher order concept, is already built into the written language.
That's correct. Actually, there's another one is very relevant to the data modeling and the modeling of the world. That is the concept of type versus instances.
Yes.
For example, in Chinese characters, sometimes you can decompose into two parts, left-hand side, right-hand side, two sub-characters together composed into one character. The left-hand side representing the type, and the right-hand side representing the instance of the particular type. For example, all the metals in the world have the same left-hand side, the same type.
I see.
So for example, all the metal have the left-hand side. So you look at the particular character, you can say, oh, that's a metal. Then you look at the right-hand side, then you can say, oh, this is one type of metal that's called steel. Another word that's the right-hand side is different, that could be a iron, could be a copper.
Right. I would imagine it would be too much to ask of the computer scientists of 4,000 years ago to come up with inheritance.
Yes, that could be too much. But probably, you know, we can go back to the Chinese language to, you know, invent some other new characters.
Oh, I see. Very good. Well, let me move on to Jose and ask you the same question, Jose. How did you get involved with computing in general and data management and data processing in particular?
Well, with computing, when I was in high school, I was enrolled in a high school program where at the end of your high school, you end up with a technical degree. So it's sort of like a vocational school in Mexico. And I was interested in electronics. And so I like to put together sort of like, you know, radios and TVs and...
So you were a typical boy.
Right. And I was, you know, playing with oscilloscopes and things like that. So then I happened to take an introductory course on digital circuits. So I got fascinated with the fact that I could build adders together and multipliers, and that was really exciting. But so as I was considering college opportunities, there wasn't really an electronics program near the town where I lived. I was living in a town which is involving the refining of oil. So the chemical engineering program in there was sort of like the best program available at the time. So I enrolled in the chemical engineering program. So I started as a chemist. And in the first year of that program, I took a course in programming.
Ah, yes.
And so I started programming in Fortran and started, you know, solving problems. And I got fascinated with the field. I basically said, this is for me. This is my life. This is what I want to do. And so immediately I decided to just look for the best computer science program available over there and, you know, move to Monterey Tech and started computer science over there.
Now, from computer science, how did you get into your lifelong passion with data? Because computer science is awfully broad.
Right. After I finished my university degree, I worked for a while as a systems programmer for some of the largest IBM sites in Mexico. And then I always wanted to do a graduate program. So I went to the University of Waterloo in Canada. So I did my master's over there. And interestingly, my thesis was on building a telephone directory for the Chinese language.
Ooh.
Ah, very
so the interesting,
interesting thing was
now you can join me to design your Chinese characters.
Yeah, you know, we're looking at user interfaces for a Chinese directory, and we're looking at the number of strokes as a possible paradigm to actually help you find
sort the
characters.
Right.
And it was, you know, an interesting
data representation was paramount for facilitating searching and sorting of this directory.
Correct.
Yes, and so you had to come up with a representation for the Chinese characters that was maybe novel, or I presume Unicode wasn't quite the fashion then than it is now.
No, it wasn't, but it was interesting for me because since I didn't know Chinese, you know, I was puzzled by, you know, what would be the best way for a non-Chinese speaker to actually find things in a Chinese telephone directory.
It often happens that a certain amount of useful ignorance can lead you to notice things that people who have the ordinary training might not know and might overlook.
Right. And then I got interested in pursuing a doctoral degree. And as I was considering what kind of discipline within computer science would make sense for me to get involved, I was just wondering, you know, of all the applications that are running in the world, how many of the applications are involved with managing of data? And I asked that question to friends and some professors, and it turned out that everybody thought that was a significant number of applications. So I thought I better get into this field.
Certainly in dollars per bit, it's the most valuable kind of application area. I mean,
but also in terms of CPU cycles.
Yes.
I mean, there is a lot of computing devoted to just managing, processing data. And so I said, you know, I think that working to make data management better should be a rich area to get into.
It must be exciting for you now, after having worked on SQL Server, which is almost pure relational model, to be working on the entity framework and sort of closing the circuit, as it were, back to the entity relationship model, which is similar but not really. What are your thoughts on the similarities and differences between the relational model, which is baked into SQL Server and most of the important products out in the marketplace today and the entity relationship model.
I think that it is interesting to see, for example, the soundness of the relational model and how robust it is and how the formalism behind it has led to a very scalable, performant technology and a very clean way to process and manipulate data. At the same time, it's been interesting to also see how frustrating it is, the gap that exists between the model of representation of the database and the higher level abstractions that applications like to use. And so when we started looking at, when we came to the realization that this particular gap that exists with applications also exists in the way we are building data services in the database, the way we are building reporting services and replication and even the SQL management tools, right, which are in some sense object views over the metadata catalogs of the database, that every single one of those services was building their own silo of mapping to bridge that gap. So when we came to that realization, I said, well, why don't we build a general piece of infrastructure that can handle data at a higher level of abstraction? You know, that was very exciting.
Well, this might be a good segue over to Britt. Let me ask you the same question. How did you get involved in computing in general and data in particular?
It actually started for me when I was in junior high school. Turns out that my teacher was married to a researcher, I think it was at the University of Chicago, who was doing research on cancer cell identification, automated. And at the time, the only output device I think we had was bright green paper. So he came into class and explained what he was doing and held up this sheet of paper that looked sort of like a big cell, but it was printed with all the characters kind of over top of each other.
So you
got the density of the ink being sort of the picture. So
the old line printer graphics.
Yes, so, and I looked at that and, you know, from across the room, it really did look like a cell. And so I was really intrigued by that. And that stuck with me for a while. I played around with stuff because he left a terminal at the classroom that I could play around with. But
so you're
I didn't really
hacker.
Get into programming. I didn't get into programming at the time, but I didn't even realize that that's what happened. You know, I was just completely a novice with respect to the technology. And then interestingly enough, early in my high school years, I happened to live near a Navy base, and there were submariners that were stationed there. In particular, there were captains of nuclear-powered submarines. These are extremely educated people. They're nuclear scientists to be able to have that role. And so one particular time I was babysitting and walked into the house and was talking to the captain in his office and saw the very broad set of books on the wall and was intrigued by that. And I noticed a book called Introduction to Programming. And I said, oh, you know, do you use computers? And I had no clue, right? And he says, oh, yeah, you know, we use them a lot. And I said, you know how to program? And he said, yes. And then he pulled that book out of the wall and said, hey, you know, would you like to take a look at this book? And I said, sure. So I actually took that book home. It was Introduction to Programming in Fortran. And I didn't have a computer. I never actually done anything but play with a few small things, but went back to my room and I never realized how much of a geek I was, but I taught myself to program Fortran without a computer.
Without a computer, very
And I literally wrote down the programs on paper and then later on was able to get my hands on a computer. And actually, I did eventually type those things in and most of them ran, I think, first time, which was kind of exciting. From there, it evolved to my first paid programming job was actually automating the schedule for a very large conference for a high school club. It was a national conference, and I somehow volunteered for this effort. And,
this is still a tricky problem for a lot of
And so I custom built a piece of scheduling software, and what I didn't anticipate in solving the problem was the volume of data that I was going to have to deal with. So there I was on my PDP-11 with floppy disk drives and was overwhelmed by the amount of data that I had to deal with because I had all these ideas about sorting and giving people their best. They were picking tracks of, you know, the same thing we all do when we go to a conference. I wanted to be fair and I wanted to make sure people got the optimal schedule. So I came up with all these kinds of algorithms and struggling with how to take in the small those algorithms and scale them up to the entire population of the conference when it didn't fit in memory was a huge issue, and I had no idea what the technology that was out there. So I invented my own sort of mini database to be able to do that. And, you know, I was reading what a bubble sort was and those kind of things and sort of teaching me myself those first algorithms. And just at that point, really locked on to this, how do you deal with massive amounts of data? And how do you write effective programs against that? And that really was actually in high school. So from there, I went and worked on one of the first commercial relational databases. That was exciting work there, and became intrigued with the impedance mismatch between programming languages and the underlying database, and,
right.
and have been in that area in one form or another for the last 20 years. So
this relates back to one of the things that Jose was talking about. The packages that are on top of the database are usually built in a different model. Nowadays, it would be an object model. In older times, it would be whatever data model was supporting by your programming language or environment, arrays or records or whatnot. This is, in some sense, it's a continuously vexing topic because you're always having to deal with this mismatch. What are your perspectives on how we're going to go forward and how this relates to the entity relationship model?
It is very interesting. If you look back at the mid-80s when the relational model was really getting commercialized and people were really starting to build apps, at the time, the programming languages that at least a large majority of business programmers used were very good at representing the scalar values that were stored in a database, but they had no ability to provide really any higher level abstraction. People didn't realize that as they built their database applications and they effectively went through the process of creating an ER model and working their way into a physical schema, they didn't realize that they were actually leaving a lot of value behind. There was no real easy, obvious way to represent that in their programming language. And what's clearly happened over the sort of lifetime as the relational side of the world has matured is programming language has moved forward to the point where they can represent that abstraction in a much more obvious way and in a way that programmers are very comfortable with. So we've now reached the point where, in fact, it's absolutely reasonable to expect a programming system to allow the programmer to capture that idea in their language, even though we may still have some more primitive storage schema that we might want to use underlying.
Underneath, right. So back in the 80s, the relational model, which has a pretty firm mathematical foundation, was being brought to market. And today we see with the entity framework, perhaps the entity relationship model is now going to be brought to market in a sort of parallel way that the sort of thing that happened in the 80s is now happening again. Dr. Chen, could you educate me a bit on the mathematical foundations of the entity relationship model? I understand the relational model. How do we turn the entity relationship model into mathematics that we can bring up?
Relational model is based on so-called mathematical relation. That's the name relation comes from. It's defined as some kind of a Cartesian product of domains or value sets. Now, the entity relationship model utilizes not only the mathematical relational theory, but also have utilized other branches of the mathematical theory. For example, something called ladder theory, also the mathematical logic and set theory. So what's happening is the major difference in terms of definition is if we put in a name and term, relational model has a mathematical definition of putting a lot of data elements and try to find out their relationship together, put into a table. The entity relationship model is one level higher, also have a mathematical formulation, but try to relate the entity together. So have a relationship built on top of entities. And then there's also another construct to build relationship of relationship, multiple levels.
I see. So I presume there's no limit to the number of levels that you could model.
That's correct.
In practice, is there a limit that human beings find to be too much?
Yes. I think in practice, people only go to two or three levels.
I'm familiar with functional programming, which is a similar kind of idea where at the bottom you have scalars and then you can have functions from scalars to scalars and you can have functions from functions to scalars and so on and mix and match. Is there some similarity between this functional model and the ER model that you're describing, the tower of abstraction there?
Yes, they're saying, you know, there are different kinds of levels in terms of the ER diagrams. The first thing I just talk about, this is more talking about the relationship of relationship. So this is the, could be, in theory, could be many levels, but in practice, people probably only envision two or three levels. The other type of thing is talking about the type of entity relationship diagrams or models of a corporation. Of a corporation in the headquarter, you may only have like 20 or 30 entity type and then relationship between them. But then you can decompose, take part of that into the division level, have another diagram, but each entity in the top level can be decomposed into multiple entity type in the division level. Then division can be decomposed to the department level and then to much lower levels. So in that kind of decomposition, it could be four or five levels
right.
in practice.
Is there a relationship? Unfortunately, this word relationship is going to get overused because it can mean anything. Do you see a relationship between functions in the mathematical sense or in the sense of functional programming and relationships in the ER model?
Okay, now, the function, if you look at mathematical term, a function actually is a subset of relation, okay, relationship. Now, one of the reason I use the word relationship is because relational model also use the word relation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So in order to differentiate that, use relationship. But in terms of the mathematical definition, it's the same thing. Now, in terms of defining a mathematical relation, if let's say we only define on two things, okay, and two entities, then basically two of them are basically on equal basis. A function means you're starting from one to the other. It's both directional. So you start with the domain, and then you get to the range. So in some way, the function is a subcomponent of a relation, mathematical relation. So however, you may view a mathematical relation in some way, sometime, can be decomposed into two functions, from one to the other, and from the other side, come back yeah. to yourself.
So the mathematical function is always between two items. Are relationships in the ER model always between two items?
No, it's possible to have more than two. You can have three or four or many.
Do you find those things being used in practice, those multi-area relationships?
Yes, and I think getting more and more popular because people naturally think that way. Think about more than two, you have three. For example, let's say you have a project delivered to some particular company which may be associated with certain kind of computer equipment. So you have three entity types,
right.
but they're all related to each other. So it's not just a binary relationship between two entity types.
Okay, now let me come back up to the entity framework and ask Jose, what are the elements of the entity framework and how do they relate to these sort of mathematical building blocks that we've tossed out on the table?
Well, one of the interesting things is that in bridging the gap between the relational model and the entity world, this is basically the challenge of all the object relational mapping technologies, right? We were puzzled about how can we formalize that particular mapping? How can we get our hands around all the possible ways in which you can actually assemble entities and relationships out of the fundamental relational building blocks? So it turns out that I have a background on relational views. So the best way for me to think about that translation process was to think in terms of views. Now, it was relatively easy to think about ways to kind of build higher level entities from views and, you know, for read.
So this is to construct entities from relations.
From relations. But then the interesting thing was, how do you reverse the mapping? How do you go back to be able to map and update at the level of the entity back into the underlying base tables? So it turns out that I did my PhD on view materialization techniques, on incremental view materialization techniques. So it became sort of like natural for me to think about reversing the problem of updating an entity, right? And then propagating the update back to the base table as if it was a materialized view. Of course, this was a realization that came in conversations with our Microsoft research people, Sergey Melnik and Phil Bernstein. But it became then natural for us to actually capture the entire mechanisms for mapping, both for read and for write in terms of views. Now, I've always thought that composition is a very important characteristic of the relational model and actually of high-level query languages like SQL and relational algebra. So a lot of people, many applications want to have their own perspective on data. There is never a fixed schema that can capture all the needs of applications. So the concept of views has always been a very interesting concept because it's a way in which you can, in some sense, build abstractions over a base set of concepts. using the power of the query language that you have available to you.
This can be very tricky, though, because often the views will destroy information, say by adding two numbers, or they will denormalize a database on purpose because the denormalized form may be easier to look at and deal with than the radically normalized form. So I can see that there's got to be an awful lot of rich machinery in there to deal with all of these tricky possibilities.
Right. But I think the interesting piece of it is that that task of composition is a very common task. It's yes. a very common need. Right. And so to the extent that the data platform that you are working on allows you to build these compositions, and it allows you to build those compositions with properties so that they can be updated, for example.
I see.
It's actually a very powerful piece of machinery that a data platform should support.
Is it a little bit like remembering the way that you built the view so that when you want to reverse it and write data back to the database, you can sort of reverse the steps?
That's right. So it's been known for a long time in the database theory and engineering that updating databases through views is a hard problem. And it's hard because many views that you can think of building are underspecified. Basically, don't carry all the information that you need to trace the legacy of the component pieces to the view, right? So if you are able to craft and build the views in a way that you can preserve the origins of the constituting pieces, then you can trace back the update and be able to propagate it back.
Okay.
And so one of the interesting things about this entity framework abstraction is that we can build tools that help designers of applications to build entity types and relationship types through views that preserve the properties of bidirectionality.
Okay, very good. I get a picture of this. Let me go over to Britt again and bring up the topic of normalization. Since you've done a lot of hardcore work in the field, my amateur's view of normalization is that it's this horribly difficult thing that data modelers need to do. And everybody hates it, and it gets in the way, and but it's necessary to maintain database integrity and all of these kind of things. What are your perspectives on that?
It's interesting, when normalization became a skill that a database programmer had to have, there was a lot of controversy about the correct way to do it and how far to go. And you know, the pendulum swings back and forth. It's interesting that what seems to happen in practice is people go to a pure normalized form and then realize that it's extremely difficult to write programs against that model. And so they try to back off as much as they can without getting into update anomalies. And the even harder part is without getting into performance issues that are really not relative to the correctness of the program, but simply the underlying implementation of the database engine. So what we're left with is a database schema often that is partially normalized, and the parts that are not, it's not clear whether it's done for convenience or for performance, because in some cases you normalize or denormalize for performance. And so you end up with really not being able to understand why the schema is the way it is in a lot of cases. And almost never is that schema the form that a programmer would like to operate in, because they don't care whether or not, or at least don't care at the when they're writing business logic, whether or not that normalized form provides them a benefit or not. They want to be able to think of it in terms of their own domain model.
Peter, do you have anything to say about normalization?
Sure. Let me say a few things. First one is, I think this normalization technique or practice actually creating a lot of so-called pseudo-experts. what happens, I went to quite a few companies and look at their design And then you also have people there to say, oh, stand up, say, oh, we designed this database to the fifth normal form.
Yeah.
what happened is, I look carefully, they are not even in the third normal form yet. Now, but that's because they claim it's fifth normal form, and they become a local expert, and nobody dare to ask them questions. Now, go back to the question of, you know, whether there's a need for normalization or not. There's a historical reason, and because the performance, because of processing technique, the engine was database engine was constructed, so there was a need to organize the data in certain normal form to avoid some kind of anomalies. However, things evolve and new things develop. Probably that kind of thing can be maintained by the system itself, so it doesn't have to be of a concern for the designer, for the developers. The good thing about using the ER model, energy generation model, is you can directly from the design stage, and then you can identify the NED type relationship type clearly if you structure that semantically meaningful. Then you already have a some kind of thermal form tables, which is meaningful and reasonable. Okay? So that's the important thing. And I think the NED framework and other things is try to provide this kind of support, high-level support.
Would you say that the third normal form is sort of the sweet spot for ordinary everyday database practitioners?
I would say yes. That's depending on where you come from. There are two kind of technique for normalization. One is to start with the entity relationship identified that. The other is to taking a lot of data element and try to identify so-called functional dependencies. And then you run through some mathematical algorithms, some software, and generating some kind of tables. And for the second kind, that's more synthetic oriented, even mathematically sound, but many people in the industry find out that's not the right way to do, because you come up with some tables, which when the developer look at that, they don't know why it's divided that way.
That's the kind of thing that Britt was saying.
Yes.
Yes. You end up having to reverse engineer your
That's
own schemas. Yes.
Yep. A lot of industry doing the reverse engineering, denormalization, and to something either for performance reason or for semantic meaningful reasons.
Now we're bringing up the S word, semantics, and there are all of these new things on the horizon, the so-called semantic web and ontologies and RDF. Let me just throw this open to anyone who'd like to comment on that. Do you see any big promise there, or do you see any roadblocks to getting there from here, or is it even worth going there? Jose, what do you think about these new semantic webs, ontology, RDF, OWL, that sort of thing?
I think that the exploration of ways to capture more semantics is a need that is just simply there. And any effort that we have into trying to capture more of the semantics of data, I mean, not just the very simple semantics that come from assembling a record for a table to higher level, which is assembling an entity and the relationships with entities, but actually even going further and then start trying to making inferences based on the logical implications and connections that exist, mathematical connections that exist between entities through relationships to other entities is an important opportunity to look forward to. And so now the question is, how do you bring those needs and the power of models that exist, like, logic programming, to the reality of a data management system that can perform and scale to the needs that they need to?
Yeah, what you're saying does remind me of Prolog, Datalog, and the infamous fifth generation project of the 80s, which didn't quite get off the ground. And it, just from my 50,000 foot perspective, it seems like the semantic web and RDF efforts are trying to resurrect those ideas. Maybe the time has come just because of Moore's Law, or do any of you think that there are some new insights that have popped up in the meantime that are going to make more logical processing feasible?
I think the one thing worth mentioning is the value of search and its role effectively as a query mechanism. And that's really where RDF comes in, is in my mind, is the fact that it provides a richer store over which to perform that kind of operation. Now, obviously, you can do the same thing with just general query as well. But we've all gone through the process from an industry perspective of wishing that this internet that we built had more semantic information in it. We weren't strictly basically scraping the text off of it and trying to figure out what it was useful for.
Can you give me an example of the kind of semantic information you have in mind?
That I think would be valuable
that would be,
add
just,
to that?
Yeah, just a sort of blue sky. If there were the utopian semantic processor out there, whatever, that semantic oracle out there, what kind of things could you do on the internet
Well, I'll throw this out there because
it's
a particular interest of mine, really around calendar and in terms of my own, managing my own time. And, there's an intersection of activities that occur in my life, and there actually is a calendar for every single one of those. I just don't know where to find them. And I'm not going to find them by searching using the standard mechanism there.
Right.
So to be able to actually collect all that information together in a useful way and not have to actively go off and personally manage it would be very valuable. It would seem that if we did have a richness around that kind of information in such a way that I could say, my current interests are around all these things, then effectively you could assemble that set of interesting events and present them to me in a way that was very useful. That's, I guess, an example of
calendar is an interesting area because it's fraught with all kinds of semantic difficulties. Like, for example, you and I are planning to have lunch in Hong Kong at 11. Is that 11 our time? And you're in New York and I'm in Seattle when we make this agreement.
Yes.
Well, the clue is it's 11, so it's probably Hong Kong time, but you never really know for sure.
Well, lunch was the key.
Yeah, that's the key word. But does your calendar software know?
Probably not.
Because when you fly from New York to Hong Kong, is it going to reset to local time? And is that 11 o'clock appointment now going to be at who knows when?
I've definitely shown up at a colleague's front door at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when it was supposed to be 9 a.m.
Yes. So, well, I want to get back a little bit to the fundamental mathematics of these things that we're talking about. The reason I want to do that is as abstraction level goes up, precision goes down, and people become confused. So it's easy to, at least for me, to write down an entity relationship model and think I've got it captured. And then when I try to teach it to the computer, I've got to turn it into something much more precise, much more practical, and I can easily confuse myself. So Peter, what do you think about these kind of things?
Can you define precisely?
Well, if I have to turn, I could draw an entity relationship model, say for students and professors in a class, and then the courses that they need to go for, and maybe the credits, and you know, by the time I'm done, I've got four or five different entities and six or seven relationships, and now I have to turn this into database tables. And the current process, and this is one of the things that Entity Framework is going to try to improve, but the current process is I have to sit down and scratch my head and essentially redesign it. The ER diagram that I drew is a nice mental picture, but now I need to teach it to the database program, and I've got to design tables and foreign keys, and I can think relationally, that's easy, but it's almost as though I have to design the system two times, once at the ER level, which is abstract, and again, at a relational level, which is more concrete. So no, I can't define precision precisely, but I can define concretely, and concrete is whatever the computer lets me do without giving me an error message.
Right. And what you describe is the process of many people around the world going through every day. They design something in terms of entity relationship model, then they have to convert that to relational schema. And that conversion either can be done manually or can be done by some kind of tool, software tool, to automate generate that. And I think one of the good things about the entity framework is try to support the ER diagram directly. So you don't have to do the conversion and operate on the logical level, the relational table level. So I think that's a really very encouraging and promising stuff.
Now, the entity framework can't be the first attempt to do this automatically, can it?
No, it's not the first attempt.
What, do you think it's going to be more successful than some of the other attempts?
I think so, because for a couple of reasons, everything has to be, no matter the idea is good or bad, has to be in right place, right time.
Yes.
And so sometimes the idea may be too early, sometimes too late, and sometimes it's in a different, the wrong place. Now, the place in this context would be the type of company, because in the past, some of the ER idea system were implemented by less well-known companies, so it didn't get the impact to the market. So I think that we have to have all the ingredients together to make things successful.
Jose, what are your perspectives on this? On the EF, the entity framework, bringing to market finally a successful tool for automating this sort of double design process that I was describing.
I think that the entity framework brings a very interesting set of opportunities to the application development world. As we said before, the existence of software analysis and design tools based on the entity relationship models or high-level abstractions like UML and things like that have been around for many years. And there have been tools that have actually automated the process of converting models at higher levels of abstractions down to concrete relational mappings and schemas, and that process has been well known. The problem that we faced before is that there was no connection between, in the software development lifecycle, between the design stage and the actual implementation stage. So those stages were kind of separated.
Or they were linked by a waterfall model, which we all remember has its own hazards of you get lost as you go down the waterfall.
Correct. So as you advance in the lifecycle of the application development, you realize that the concrete implementation has to evolve to satisfy many of the operational requirements, workloads of the application.
And it ends up having to feed back all the way to the highest level design. And if you don't build that feedback into your process, you end up reverse engineering.
Right. And that has been the missing link. So as the software development cycle advances and the application actually becomes more and more concrete, the distance between what you started with in the design and what's actually the implementation starts diverging. So now when you have the entity framework, which is concrete realization of the entity relationship model, the opportunity to keep the implementation and the actual model in sync all the way through the application lifecycle increases. So now you can start thinking about raising the level of abstraction and actually provide tools that are based and driven by the models. This is sort of like a very important ingredient in realizing the vision of model-driven software development.
It sounds very exciting. Britt, can you sort of paint word pictures for us of kind of experiences we would expect with EF and what the screens would look like, what my day-to-day work would be like using it?
I think one of the interesting scenarios to talk about is that we imagine a world where people invest their time in building their own domain-specific model, the way they would like to be able to approach the world. And they may do that directly, sort of in a forward fashion, or they may reverse engineer that from some existing set of data sources, right. Or actually likely a combination of the two. But once they make that investment there, the value of that is something that we want to be able to let the enterprise leverage over time. So there's a very simple example that I like to talk to people about, and that is that imagine if you invested in that model and now you can have your programmers off creating business logic in those terms so that when you're maintaining that system, it's in those terms and you can educate your programmer force in your business so that they can continue to move that forward and provide substantial new function around that as well. But you can also take that kind of information or that artifact and use it for something like report writing, which is a very completely different skill, completely potentially depending on the size of the organization, completely different skill set and different person involved in that. And using that same model, be able to go off and generate reports. In fact, it's interesting. My perspective on that is that that's a case, if you look at report writing in general, that is a case where this obvious step that we're taking in terms of building this infrastructure, the market drove that. And if you look back at report writing, when that marketplace was new, it was really the fact that it was very hard to get reports. And so there was a determination, we have to take it out of the programmer from hand coding them in some low-level programming language, and we have to provide higher-level tools. And so if you look at that space, it's evolved to where there is this notion of a report writer person. They generally create some higher level domain model that they use within their report writing environment, and then they use their report writing tools on top of that. So it's happened in that space, but not happened in a way that's reusable by any other parts of the organization.
There's just this new model in his
And so
head.
That's actually one of the things that we're going to change, is that to allow that to be reused across that.
So
now, it's not necessarily the exact same model.
Right.
And that's the other part that we're going to have to be able to figure out, is there's going to be related models and be able to maintain those relationships over time is another area, rich area for us to understand.
But there are vestiges of this kind of movement in the product now, in that the business intelligent components have their own sort of little modeling language or little languages in each one of these tool sets that come along with SQL Server.
Absolutely. So one of the points Jose made earlier, if we apply it here, if you look at report writing in general, the key requirement there is to allow the report writer individual to be able to write queries in terms of their view. If you ask them to operate at the storage schema level, they will fail, which is how we got to building those high-level applications in the first place. being able to essentially write queries in terms that make sense to the user is what it's all about.
Well, we have just a few minutes left. Let me see if we can stuff in some thoughts on object-oriented programming. Object-oriented programming predisposes its own data model, which is very different from the relational model, quite different from the entity relationship model, very different from the XML node-labeled trees model. In some sense, the object-oriented model is a edge-labeled graph model because you can point from anything to any other thing, and you can have multiple input arcs to things. Just taken as a bouillabaisse like that, it seems like an impossible problem to bridge the gap amongst all these different models. The reality is application programmers today are writing in object-oriented programming languages, and they need to get at the entity relationship model and the underlying relational model and even the XML model somehow, some way through their object oriented. That's their portal to the world. Peter, let me start with you. How do you see us resolving this? Is just the impedance mismatch in new clothing again. How do you see us resolving it? Maybe it'll never be fully resolved, but moving forward and providing good products and practices for people.
Yeah, I think the object oriented languages or the models development process, basically, if you look at deeply, it's basically a packaging of entity relationship, but you take the entity, means the data, and then also the associated methods together and encapsulate that, become an object. So it's a way of, in mathematical sense, is a projection. Take the data and project it, all the methods to that. Now, that's in my view, it's a specialized view, a specialized way of programming, okay? Now, based on that programming, you're developing certain kind of object model, which in some ways compatible with EDR model, in some ways not. So there's some kind of impedance match. So I think, but if you do a deeper analysis, maybe some specialists, they can look at that and do the conversion themselves. So in some way it can be done, but it may not be perfectly every cases, but in majority of the object probably can be supported and converted.
Jose, what do you think?
Well, this is very interesting because before I came to Microsoft, I was working on object-oriented database systems, and I was part of that,
big effort.
The early 90s to try to bring object-oriented database technology to reality. One of the main contributions of object-oriented database systems, or at least the efforts of the early 90s, was that those efforts took a very strong position into trying to reflect the type systems of the programming languages 100% in the database. And so one of the huge contributions of the engineering and the research at the time was that it was possible to build, for example, object database systems that reflected 100% the type system of a language like Smalltalk or Lisp or C++. And there were a lot of very interesting techniques to be able to handle hard parts of the problem, like pointers, okay? There were techniques that actually allowed the state of the object in memory to be reflected and to be persisted, so that
when persistent variations of the programming languages.
Correct. And there were techniques like pointer swizzling and a whole bunch of things developed at a time to actually reflect the reality of the object as processed by the programming language environment 100%. Now, the problem with that approach was that while the programming environment was reflected very accurately, very faithfully by the persistent system, when dealing with large collections of objects, the query capabilities and the transactions, were not up to snuff, okay? So all these ideas about normalization and mapping and dividing and separating these things turn out to be important. With the entity framework, I think that we are providing a balance between the two. If you look at an object is a piece of state and a piece of behavior. So we think of entities as capturing 100% the structural state of the object and be able to build views that reflect that. And then the transformation of entities into objects reflected is, we view it as a presentation problem. It's a matter of wrapping those entities very simply into objects and then adding the behavioral capabilities of it.
So by giving up on the necessity for 100% fidelity of the type system, we get something that we can actually bring to market, a real system. Last words for you, Britt. We have a couple of minutes left.
Well, I think building on what Peter and Jose said, what we're seeing as programmers have evolved to embrace object-oriented programming over the last 10, 15 years is that they've now realized that they are all building, at least many of these large systems, are building what we commonly call a data access layer, which is actually hand-coding the complex mapping between the way they want to view the world in their object model and the way the world is stored in their databases.
Right.
And they're struggling with the fact that to be able to maintain that code itself, but also maintain it in a way that allows them to be able to think of query in terms of that, their model. They're struggling with not being able to do that. And people have formalized that investment, and there's a lot of products out that have tried to solve that problem. So back to what Peter said, I think the time is right. The languages have evolved to a point. In fact, if we don't have time to get into Link here, but that's even more evidence of that time, which highlights that even more. And the fact that the industry has experience in solving this problem, the impedance mismatch problem with object-oriented languages, and now understands that there's a place for this type of component in the system and that it has real value and reduces the cost of programming. One of the things that I like to think about in terms of the bottom line for the entity framework is simply when it's adopted by a project, you write less code. So fundamentally, you're going to get more work done, and it's going to be more performant and ultimately more reliable because there's less of it.
I think that's everybody's measure of success. The less code you write, the better. Well, let me take this opportunity to thank you, Britt Johnston, Jose Blakely, and Peter Chen. I hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as I did, and I'm so sorry that the hour is over now. This is Brian Beckman for Microsoft Corporation. Thank you.